The following is a lecture given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami on October 31st, 1990 in New Orleans, Louisiana. The class begins with a reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd Canto, Chapter 23, Verse 39.
Vihara Kula Chalendra Dronishwananga Sakamaruta Sobagasu Dronishwananga Sakamaruta Sobagasu Siddhayanuto Nyudhunipata Sivaswanasu Siddhayanuto Dhyudhunipata Sivaswanasu Reme chiram dhana dhaval lalana varuti. Reme chiram dhana dhaval lalana varuti. Tenashta loka pavihara kula chalendra. Dronishwananga sakamaruta sobagasu. Tonishwananga sakamaruta sobagasu Siddhayanuto nyudhunipata sivaswanasu Reme chiram dhana dhavallalana varuti.
Translation. In that aerial mansion, he traveled to the pleasure valleys of Mount Meru, which were rendered all the more beautiful by cool, gentle, fragrant breezes that stimulated passion. In these valleys, the treasure of the gods Kuvera, surrounded by beautiful women and praised by the Siddhas, generally enjoys pleasure. Kardama Muni also, surrounded by the beautiful damsels and his wife, went there and enjoyed for many, many years. Report by Srila Prabhupada. Kuvera is one of the 8 demigods who are in charge of different directions of the universe. It is said that Indra is in charge of the eastern side of the universe, where the heavenly planet or paradise is situated. Similarly, Agni is in charge of the southeastern portion of the universe. Yama, the demigod who punishes sinners, is in charge of the southern portion. Niriti is in charge of the southwestern part of the universe. Varuna, the demigod in charge of the waters, is in charge of the western portion. Vayu, who controls the air and who has wings to travel in the air, is in charge of the northwestern part of the universe. And Kuvera, the treasurer of the demigods, is in charge of the northern part of the universe. All these demigods take pleasure in the valleys of Mount Meru, which is situated somewhere between the sun and the earth. In the aerial mansion, Kardama Muni traveled throughout the 8 directions controlled by the different demigods described above. And as the demigods go to Mount Meru, he also went there to enjoy life. When one is surrounded by young beautiful girls, sex stimulation naturally becomes prominent. Kardama Muni was sexually stimulated and he enjoyed his wife for many, many years in that part of Mount Meru. But his sex indulgence was praised by many, many siddhas, beings who have attained perfection, because it was intended to produce good progeny for the good of universal affairs. Thus in the Bhaktivedanta Swami translation purport of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 23, Text 39, here in New Orleans, 1st of November, 1990. 504 Gorupta. 27th. Huh? Oh, still? Oh, 31st of October. So, history of Kardama Muni and Devahuti. Kardama Muni was a great mystic yogi, one of the Prajapatis in charge of populating the universe with good progeny. And he was performing severe austerities for a long time. And his austerities and meditation was so pure that Lord Vishnu himself appeared to him. Vishnu, who is the super soul in everyone's heart, knew that Kardama Muni wanted to, was not ready to take the renounced order of life immediately, but wanted to go through the Grihastha ashram and fulfill the instructions of his superiors to produce progeny. But after that, experiencing the householder life, he wanted to take renounced life. So Kardama Muni was concerned that he have a proper Krishna conscious mate in order to pursue the household life. So after performing these austerities, and Lord Vishnu blessed him that he would get a good Krishna conscious wife and would be able to take to leave the Grihastha life and take a renounced order life in due course. So soon after that, Manu came and appealed to Kardama Muni to accept his daughter. Although she was a great princess, she was very attracted by the austerity and spiritual force of Kardama Muni and wanted to marry him. He said, since you desire to get married and this proposal is coming of its own accord, you don't have to work for it. Sometimes somebody wants to get married, they have to look a long time to get a proper wife or wife to get a proper husband. But here everything was coming of its own accord, so he was saying that you should just, it's not very auspicious if you refuse something but coming of its own accord when it's something you want anyway. Because if out of some false ego you don't take it just because it's the first proposal. But then later on you may have to be embarrassed because people, you'll be looking for the same thing and you may not get it. So anyway, through various very tactful words, diplomatic words, and Swayambhuva Manu makes his petition to Kardama Muni, accepted Devahuti as his wife. But he remained in his hermitage in the mountains meditating, and Devahuti for a long time was serving him just like a menial maidservant there. So being a princess, they had so many people to take care of the princess, to wash her, to bathe her. So like the movie stars that get a lot of beauty sleep and a lot of care, Devahuti was extremely beautiful, but when she was working just as the wife of Kardama Muni in the ashram, she became kind of strange. She didn't have the opportunity for that type of intensive care. So she actually just became like an ordinary maidservant in terms of her complexion, her hair, everything. So Kardama Muni, she requested that to him one time, and he said, I'm very satisfied with your service, what would you like? He said, well, we got married with the purpose of having good Krishna conscious children, so I'd like to have children from you, but now I've become ugly and plain, so maybe I'm not so attractive anymore for you. And Kardama Muni said, yes, so the purpose of marriage is to have a Krishna conscious, at least one Krishna conscious child. So he, using mystic power, called the various Gandharva ladies to come, and they took her under the water and bathed her and transformed her back to her former beauty. She came out of the water again, a beautiful princess. And so then Kardama Muni, in order to have children, you have to have sex life. In order to have sex life, you have to be attracted sexually to the other person. He had to be able to distinguish between a man and a woman. And so now that she was very nicely decorated, even in Vedic, in the Vedas, for the Garbhodan Samskar, it says that the couple should be well decorated, very attractive to the other person, bathe, things like that, so that the sexual desire will be stimulated, so that there can be procreation. So here, Kardama Muni, he's kind of compacting his entire grihastha life into a period of one pretty short intensive period. He wants to experience what is the material pleasure, but he's doing that in a way dovetailing it to Krishna, because his guru wanted that he produce, his father, that he produce progeny for the universe. So he had promised his wife he'd give one son and then he would leave and take sannyas. It's a kind of a different situation. His son would grow up and protect the, when the son would grow up enough to protect the wife, then he would leave. That was the arrangement. Just like here in America, when two millionaires get married, sometimes they sign an agreement. Who gets the money? How does it divide it or whatever? They have some agreement nowadays. Marriage. So this was like a marriage agreement was there, apart from the religious vows, that he said that I'm not going to remain with you forever. Only until your son's big enough to take care of you, then I'm going. So this is explaining how he, after going through these great austerities, he is now uniting with his wife and to have children. So using some of his mystic potency, he's created a beautiful flying mansion. He's going to the gardens of the demigods. He's going, this is his honeymoon, you can say. He's going for experiencing what is the happiness of material life. After experiencing and after, of course things didn't work out exactly as planned. He promised he'd give his wife a son, but the first child was a daughter, with daughters. So she said that he was going to leave, but he said, wait, you said you're going to give me a son. So then he had to, it's like nothing ever works out, even for great yogis, exactly the right way. Always some surprises. So, none, he did, in spite of what appears to be a pretty opulent situation of sense gratification, but that's what it was. It was sense gratification. Grihasthas have a license to have sense gratification. One of the points of grihastha life is that before one can take renounced life, is one should have experienced what is the material happiness enough that one doesn't have any more doubt that I miss something. Right? Somebody's a brahmachari and then they may not feel determined to or ready to take a renounced life because, well, their mind is attracted to material things to some degree. It's not peaceful. So going through the grihastha life on one side is that to regulate someone and to control the nature. Also, for some, in this case he was supposed to have children. Also, he wanted to understand what was material life. What was material happiness. So then, when he would renounce, it would be complete. It wouldn't like this. What happened one time with when Shankaracharya was traveling and preaching, there was one great tantric yogini, a lady tantric, saying this is Halloween day, I guess, it's applicable. She was someone who was expert in various type of tamasic, magical aspects of the Vedas. And many of these things are connected with sex life. So, because at the age of 9, Shankaracharya had taken sannyas, so she said that challenged him to a debate, and so she asked him some kind of intimate question, which only someone who had sex life would know. But having taken sannyas, how could he reply it? So she was trying to trick him because it was in a debate, whoever can defeat the other person is the winner. So since his body, the sannyas is for the duration of his body was not to be polluted by or be contaminated or engaged in any kind of sex life. But what he did is he went into yogic meditation, left his body, and of course now they call astral projection, but this is something more than that. This is a more dynamic form of astral projection, you can call it. But as a yogi, he left his body, and in his subtle body, he went, and there was, just at that time, there was a king who was on his deathbed. He was dying. So just after the soul of the king left the body and went on to its next birth, then Shankaracharya entered into the king's body. You know, everybody's mourning, the wife, and he sits up, you know, and wow, I thought he was dead. He's like, but just at that second, as soon as the one soul left, took by the Yamadutas or whoever, he entered into the body and came up. Then everybody, oh, he's back, you know, it's like, what a remarkable, you know, all active and remarkable recovery. So then that night, he had relations with the queen. Queen was really surprised. He's on his deathbed, you know. Experienced whatever the thing was that this tantric yogini had challenged him that he didn't know. And then the next day the king dies. You know, nobody knows what's going on, you know, from their point of view. And of course, nobody knew what was going on as far as his private life, but the queen was pretty nice. All this time, Shankaracharya is just like, his body is there in trance. Everybody's waiting, you know, after a couple of days or whatever. Then he comes out of trance again and answers the question, completely surprising this yogini, and defeats her. So, without having broken his vow. Anyway, this is possible for Shankaracharya. Great Lord Shiva incarnation. But we, the Vaishnavas, don't get in this type of debates. Even Rama Rupa and Sanatana Goswami, someone came on some kind of material learning debate level, they just say, okay, you're better than I am. Haribol, you know. They weren't into protecting themselves. One time, some big pundit came like that, and he said, I challenge you to a debate to Rupa and Sanatana. And then he said, what, do you want us, you want to say you're more scholarly than we are? I said, yes. Okay, where, somewhere we can sign? We'll sign you. Who has time to waste arguing with these people? They don't want to know anything about Krishna Gandhi. Then what happened was, he went to see Jiva Goswami. He said, see, I've already defeated your guru, so you can sign here. I said, what? So he couldn't take that because he knew Rupa and Sanatana, much more learned than this guy. So then he got in a debate and defeated them. But then later Rupa and Sanatana heard about it and they were upset, according to the story. Externally they were upset, why are you wasting time arguing with these people? Material wranglers. Of course, it was because of honor of his guru that he did. But they were, externally, internally, they were probably satisfied that he was doing it for the right purpose. But externally, just to show that it's not our purpose just to go and argue with people. Even if we can defeat them, what's the use? So generally, the Vaishnavas avoid this kind of wrangling. So back to the original point was that In order to fully be fixed in pure Krishna consciousness, the devotee needs to be firmly convinced that there's nothing more than Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness has everything that we need. It's all that there is, in the sense that it is the spiritual eternal reality, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur was saying, Nam bina kichu nahi ko ar chodav bhuvano maje. And in the 14 worlds, there's nothing else but the holy name. This is the eternal reality. All the material things are simply temporary. They're not, they're just a flickering kind of superficial happiness. But in order to realize that, some people may realize that theoretically, and they can remain fixed by experiencing Krishna consciousness. But generally, before one gets renunciation, they have to first experience what is actually the enjoyment. So if that's done in an unregulated, in an improper way, without any kind of spiritual objective, then one could also get misled. So Karna Muni had the authority to have children, he got married in a proper way, everything was done in a very proper way. At the same time, he enjoyed in a way which was like comparable not with just a human being, but comparable on a level the way the demigods enjoy. So, whatever there was to enjoy in material householder life and sex life, without losing sight of the objective or without completely going, oh, but in a very, you know, wonderful kind of paradise kind of situation, he had his honeymoon and his wife conceived after this period of time. Unfortunately for him, or fortunate for Devahuti, whatever, she had first had girls, so then she said, well, you have to give me a son, so I had to go through the whole thing once more. So after experiencing that, then Karna Muni, he was clear, okay, this is what material life is, and then he was determined, okay, now I can see, you know, it's a temporary happiness, this is the limit of it. And he didn't want any more of it. He was, he had enough, and he wanted to go back to experiencing, to fully concentrating on transcendental realization. So this is the reason why sex life is regulated and in Krishna consciousness, why there are certain systems of marriage and so many other things, so that people can continue to progress on their spiritual life. It's not just like cats and dogs. That doesn't mean that a householder doesn't experience fully what is household life. They shouldn't have any, within the system given, they shouldn't have any doubt that, okay, I didn't experience fully what grihastha life is. Because then, if they would take renounced life and their renunciation was not complete, they thought, well, because my household life wasn't really happy, therefore, because I didn't have the right wife, I didn't really experience what sex life was or something fully. So then if that nags them in their mind, what is the question of their renunciation? Their renunciation is incomplete. And they may fall down and feeling incomplete in their material experience. Daksha, of course, gave huge lectures on this point. But his point was that, you know, you enjoy your whole life and then at the last bit you renounce. That's one way of doing it, but Daksha took it to the other extreme. Narada Muni didn't consider that someone has to go through the grihastha life to renounce. It's a question of spiritual transcendental knowledge. If someone can learn from others' experience, sees that other people are enjoying the material life, but they're still not happy. So some people are able to, just by this viewing the situation in the world, they're able to be firm in their renunciation, firm in their vows of Krishna consciousness. So this way, Narada Muni made the sons of Daksha into renounced devotees. And they didn't get married. But if somebody doesn't have that perspective, and they want to experience, so there's a license, Prabhupada said, grihasa life is a license for sense gratification. But that's purified because it's for having children, and it's done in a regulated manner. So where grihasthas live their whole life together and they regularly try to have children and according to the Garbhodhan Samskar. Here, Karna Muni was kind of different. He, his whole life, his whole grihastha life, he's doing tapasya. And at one time, like kind of a honeymoon, he's just going to have one time. Apparently the yogis also, they know how to control themselves and all these activities. I don't want to go into all these explicit details, but they have a lot of control, and if they can create planets, they can do a lot of different things. So he controlled himself, but his situation was one intense period of one procreation, and then after that, take renounced life. So it's a kind of a different scenario. It's kind of a condensed grihastha life, all in a few weeks or whatever. As it was, it worked out a couple of years, because they had to wait for the child to be born. And he went back to his meditation and left. That's why the heading of this chapter is called Devahuti's Lamentation. And she gets married, serves her husband, and then he experiences grihastha happiness, gives her children, and he's off. But that was the deal. He didn't want to stay in the house his whole life. He wanted to. He was a great yogi. He wasn't an ordinary person. And that was the arrangement they made. Of course, Devahuti lost her husband in this way. But because Karna Muni was such a great devotee, a great yogi, and because Devahuti was such a pious girl, she got Kapila Muni, the incarnation of Godhead, as her son. You see, she did tremendous austerities as a princess, to live in a hermitage and just clean the pots and cook and wash the ashram and get the firewood from the forest and do so. These are great austerities. Grihastha life means that the husband and wife have to also, it's not only enjoyment, they have to also accept to do their services and accept the austerities. It's a responsible type of life. Unless one is able to completely dedicate oneself in the renounced life like Karna Muni was able to, then there's no reason to separate from the wife. It's not that Karna Muni left his wife and went off with some other woman, or that he left and did some kind of materialistic activity. He only left because this was agreed that once his son was born and grown enough, he was going to just fully dedicate himself into Krishna consciousness without bothering about the family life. He was fully going to engage in devotional service and sannyas life, whatever. So that's the only time when it's considered legitimate for the husband to leave the family, because it's for a higher purpose. If one leaves the family and just for some other sense gratification, then it's considered irreligious. So these are stories that require a lot of understanding of the background and of the to really get a proper perspective. Otherwise it just seems like if you just open up to this particular verse that, well, Karna Muni's having a real good time here, but doesn't give you the actual perspective that what is his actual objective in the whole thing. The point is that one should never lose sight of the goal, and certainly he wasn't losing sight of the goal, but in order, he knew that for his renunciation to be complete, he had to also have a complete experience. And he didn't want to mess around over 50 years to do it. He just wanted to do it and get it over with. And then he knew that theoretically material life was not complete compared to spiritual life. So he already knew what the conclusion was, but he just wanted to practically realize it. So that he would, and that's a legitimate objective. That's one of the objectives of household life, is to prepare one to be fully fixed in Krishna consciousness. One doesn't have to take sannyas to do that. Householders can also experience the love of Krishna even while being householders, and that they do become detached from the material life. Although as a householder they had to live with certain material facilities, but they can at the same time develop through faith and devotion to Guru and Krishna, they can fully become more attached to Krishna than they are to the material things. The material things are just part of their particular ashram. There's a story in Ramanuja's pastimes about how Ramanuja tested. Their people were complaining that there was this one Grihastha. He was actually it's an interesting story that there was a big festival going on, and they were taking the deities in procession through the town. But and everybody was looking at the deities and were worshipping the deities, but there was this one handsome young man carrying an umbrella for a beautiful girl and just looking at her face the whole time. Just like this, you know, it's like to the point where everybody like laughing at the guy, like he's like, you know, just completely staring at her face, carrying the umbrella, like completely infatuated, to the point where the deity is going by and he doesn't even know the deity is going by. He doesn't know there's 20,000 people in the street. It's like he's just completely infatuated by this girl. So then the whole festival goes by, you kind of walking through the town. Now Ramanuja is going back to the ashram after the festival's over, and here he still sees this guy walking with the girl and the umbrella, you know, down the street, you know, and then he sends over a disciple and says, "You ask that person to come here. I want to talk to him, you know. Where is this guy at? You know, walking all over the town, you know, looking like somebody in trance, you know." Then he was in trance. So even the disciple went over to talk to him, and he couldn't even get his attention. He's just like, finally, like in fact, like to tap him on the shoulder. "Hey, you know, how, you know, hi, ball." And then he kind of, "Oh, wow, yeah," like waking out of a dream, you know. "What is it you want?" And then he said, "Here, there's Ramanuja, the great sannyasi acharya. He's there, Yati Raj. He'd like to speak with you." And then, "Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah." Then he goes over and bows down to Ramanuja and said, "Yes, I'm very fortunate to meet you. How can I serve you?" He said, "Well, I just wanted to know that you don't know that it was just a huge festival. You're going, you're walking all over the town holding this umbrella, looking at this woman's face. You don't know anything that's going on. What is your idea? I don't understand." He said, "Well, I am so-and-so. I'm a great professional wrestler from such and such place. And I just can't, when I look at her eyes, that's all I don't need anything else. And I'm just like, I want to get married. Are you married?" He said, "No, I'm not married. But in the future, we're thinking about getting married." So it's kind of an unusual situation in Vedic society, normally young man, young woman like that, intimately connected. Because he was a wrestler, which is not like kind of really, it's kind of a like an entertainer type of a, you know, not much different from now. Wrestlers, well, professional wrestler, like not in the upper echelons of society in terms of you know, civilization or something, but you know, a little bit on one side of society in terms of Vedic society's strict rules. And certainly to be a dancing girl or a courtier for some lord or a king was also kind of like a society girl, a movie star or something. So it's like they were kind of entertainers, like a little bit part of society that was not known for really strictly following all the rules like brahmanas and kshatriyas, isn't it? So, but still it was pretty unusual. So Ramanuja said, "Be much better if you got married. Walking in the street like that with your girlfriend's not really proper in those days." Anyway, Ramanuja asked him that, I have somebody who has more beautiful eyes. Are you willing to see that person? And he said, sure. Why not? So you come with me, you come and meet me at this place tonight at 6 o'clock and I'll show you more beautiful eyes. He said, I'll come, but I can't believe there's any more beautiful eyes in my whatever name was it. Then the boy went back over, took his umbrella and then down the street again. Samadhi. That night, he came where he met Ramanuja, and Ramanuja took him in a very dark room into a place. Actually, he was taking him into the temple. In those days, there's no electricity. It's over about 1500 years ago. And the temples, the arti was actually when you showed the light, you were showing the whole deity. So, then the pujari was doing an arti, and then different parts of the deity were being revealed, and finally took the arti lamp from the lotus feet up to the eyes. When he saw the eyes of the deity, then that man was startled, that wrestler, and he became amazed. His heart became purified by the blessing of Ramanuja. He could realize the transcendental beauty of the lotus eyes of Lord Vishnu. And then he fell down at the feet of Ramanuja and said that, you know, I realized the most beautiful thing in the whole world. But I couldn't, I was infatuated by some temporary thing. Anyway, Ramanuja, he went back and that man went and preached to the girl, and she actually was more devotional than the boy anyway. So the boy surrendered and became a disciple of Ramanuja. And then the girl, she also separately came and surrendered to Ramanuja. They became bhaktin. Then Ramanuja initiated him and then initiated her and told him to get married. So then they lived together as grihasthas. But he was a very dedicated servitor of Ramanuja, so I think it's the same person. I hope I didn't get two stories mixed up. I think it's the same person, but he would, when Ramanuja would come back from the bathing in the Kaveri River, he would hold on to this disciple's arm, who was very powerful, like a bodyguard or something. He would take him back. But he was very active servitor, and he was quite intelligent, actually. Industrious person. And I hope it's the same person. I think it's the same. I think, you read that, is it the same couple? I think it's the same. Maybe I get it mixed up. I think it's the same couple. There's two. Ramanuja had one disciple like this who was a wrestler, another one who was a Vaishya. The Brahmanas were envious of both. And there's two different stories, I don't remember, but one of the stories, I got it crisscrossed, was that, the Brahmanas, they were complaining that why Ramanuja is giving so much attention to this non-Brahmana, especially the Grihastha. So then Ramanuja did a test and he went into the ashram of the Brahmanas and cut off everyone's dhotis are 6 yards. So he just took off a few inches from each dhoti and mixed around some of the kopins of the sannyasis. And they got up in the morning and then they found it. Who ripped my dhoti? Who took my kopin? And they had a big fight, yelling and screaming, And then it came up to Ramanuja, someone is doing this, disturbance in our ashram, And he said, come on, you renounce the whole world and someone takes your kopin, you're so upset. I mean, you got 6 yards of cloth, someone takes a few inches, I had to kind of calm everybody down. They didn't reveal that he actually was the one that instigated it. But then he said, let's test these grihasthas, see where they're really at, they must be really attached. You two go, and you steal the jewels and the gold from the lady. She's got so many golden ornaments, they must be really attached. So they snuck in and I went in through the door, through the roof, the different kind of versions of it. They went in. Meanwhile, the wife she's just kind of resting, waiting for her husband to come. So she's lying on the bed, but she was fully dressed with her jewels on, because he was coming back a little later that night, and so she was going to give him the evening meal. She wasn't fully dressed to go to bed, but just kind of resting. So she had her ornaments on, and she saw that here these two brahmanas are coming and said, well, they look like my godbrothers. Anyway, they must be wanting some service for the guru. So she just played as if she was asleep. And they came and they saw that she was wearing all the jewelry. So then what to do. So then they kind of carefully try to take off the jewelry. She's just playing, she's asleep, she's aware. But it's because she's laying there like this, half the jewelry's under. So she thought, you know, Guru must need the, for some reason doesn't want to ask, but must need it. I've only been able to give half. The other half is under me. So then she thought, well, let me just kind of make believe like when you're sleeping, I roll over in my sleep and they can get the other half. So she rolls over. They freak out. My God, she woke up or something. They just run off, you know, they get frightened and then they hide, see what happened. Rama says, steal it and then just wait and see what happens. So a little while later, the husband comes, sees his wife with like half jewelry, one earring, one, you know, like, one bracelet, you know, what happened? And she said, well, it's like this. I was lying down, I was awake, but I was resting a little bit, and then I saw that the Brahmin disciples of our guru came, and then they, so I just waited, well, maybe they need something. Since they're coming like that, sneaking, I didn't say anything. But they came, and then they wanted to start taking their jewelry, so I thought maybe the guru needs the jewelry, so I think what to do. And then, so I kind of rolled over, playing like I'm rolling over my sleep, so they could get the other half. But they ran off. The husband chastised it. This is because of your false ego. You thought you were giving to the guru. Nothing is yours. Everything already belongs to the guru. Because of your false ego, you couldn't give 100%. Only 50% you could give. Because you thought it was yours. And then she said, yes, she started crying. Yes, I have no surrender to the guru. Actually, you know, I should have realized it was all the guru's, you know. Who am I to think I'm giving? He's just coming and taking his own belongings. So then, the Brahmins are like completely shocked, you know. He's really, you know, but not what they expected. They thought they're gonna scream, oh, who took our tools, you know. They went back and they reported to Ramanuja. And so Ramanuja called all the Brahmins, said, okay, this is what happened. They all heard the story. They're all like amazed. So who is more brahminical? I was actually the one who told your dotis. I just said, you had 6 yards. Of 6 meters of cloth, 6 yards, and you lost a few inches and you're all screaming. They have valuable, you know, gold which you could buy 1,000 dhotis with. And they lost, and they're lamenting they couldn't give everything to the guru if he wants it. And then they all have to admit that they're much more brahminical than we are. So I said, you should see the Vaishnava as belonging to a particular caste. The Brahmanas, a Vaishnava is already considered to have all the qualities of a Brahmana. So, in this way, the purpose of Krishna consciousness is to achieve full devotional service. To see that everything is Krishna's. And someone, even in a grihastha ashram, even though they have some license that they can have sense gratification in a regulated way, but there are also many grihasthas, many examples of grihasthas who, although they're fulfilling that particular role as a grihastha, but their consciousness is more attached to Krishna, more attached to the Guru, and they see that ultimately everything is the property of Guru and Krishna. And they're not like, they may take the position humbly in social or in prayers that we're attached to grihasthas, but they may actually be more detached. Sometimes someone in renounced order, they're attached to very small things. Someone doesn't say, give them the respect or something, they get all offended, you know. Some little thing happens and they get upset. So it's simply different ashrams to work in. And socially, Vedic society gives more respect to renunciation because that's a superficial thing that people can superficially see is renunciation. But the Vaishnavas, they understand that more than even superficial renunciation is one's actual attachment to Krishna in devotional service and one's understanding that everything is Krishna's and that everything should be done for the pleasure of Krishna. So that's even a higher level of renunciation. When Bhaktivinoda Thakur went to his guru and asked to take sannyas, he was a grihastha with 13 children. His guru told him that you're already a sannyasi. You're already as good as a sannyasi because everything you do is for the pleasure of Krishna, which is the real purpose of sannyas. Tridandi sannyas means that word, thoughts, and actions, these are the three dandas, they should be offered through the control of the intelligence and the soul for the pleasure of Lord Krishna. That is the real meaning. So if someone is able to do that in grihastha life, they're also considered like grihastha brahmacharis or as good as a sannyasi. Of course, it's difficult, but In Krishna's eyes, someone who is fully engaging in devotional service is in whatever ashram they are, he recognizes that Lord Chaitanya would accept, whether someone was a renounced or whether they were a grihastha, depending on how they were engaging in devotional service. What he didn't like was that somebody was a renounced order and then he was associating intimately with women. He would, because that's hypocritical. You're getting social respect, you're taking vows to be active as a renounced. That gives you the freedom. You don't have to get married. You don't have to do all these things. But at the same time, you renounce your family, or you renounce and you take, and then again, you're mixing with some women. This is really bad. You would reject that person. Similarly, in those days, of course, people were more responsive. If they were grihastha, there wasn't things like wife swapping and divorce and things like that. People were taking it as a religious duty. They would get married, and they're already expert in finding a proper compatible match. Also, in the both parties were trained that this was what grihastha life entailed, what it was the duty of the different people. And so generally they would follow. If the husband wanted to leave and take sannyas, that could only be under the, there had to be some reason for that, not just whimsically that someone could do that. But so they would follow the grihastha life, and Lord Chaitanya, he gave mercy to his grihastha disciples, sometimes named their babies, some gave them instruction to have children and different things. But they would engage in their devotional service from the grihastha ashram. In society, the very few people take a renounced order. And that usually people go through grihastha, and at the end, some people might take a renounced order. Very few people take at an early age. It's a very rare circumstance. Even Ramanuja was a grihastha before he took renounced life, but his wife didn't cooperate, so he gave her an ultimatum. 2 strikes and then you're out. In America, 3 strikes and you're out, but he told her 2 strikes and you'll be out. But anyway, so these histories also give us a lot of instruction. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Ram Hare Hare. Any questions?
What happens though when a person outwardly is discouraged with us, inwardly
he's dishonest? I don't know if I understand exactly what. You mean someone doesn't like, someone says, well, they think that if I'm a grihastha, if I'm responsible for my wife, and I have to have children, I gotta pay the rent, I gotta pay the mortgage, or whatever I have to pay, I have to do all the, maintain the children, and all these parts the person doesn't like, but he dislikes, you know, the sex part of it he likes, but all the rest of it, you know, doesn't like. That's what you're asking about? Yeah, that's why being a grihastha is considered responsible. There's a difference between being a dog or a cat. And even a dog or a cat, they feel something. At least they, you know, a bird brings food back for the babies. If someone wants to be like a, you know, less than a worm or something, you know, just enjoy and then forget about it without any higher purpose. So that's uncivilized. That's maybe less than an animal or like some very low animal. Some kind of fish or something where they just procreate and then swim off. And even the fish seem to kind of swim in schools to protect their little, whatever you call them, minnows. It's natural. Who's going to like all those things? But that's part of life. If you're going to create a progeny, then you have to also be responsible. I think that in America, many states, if not all the states, for a parent to be totally irresponsible and neglect their children and their family, it's a criminal offense. You want the enjoyment, but you don't want the responsibility. That's why, of course, people purchase contraceptives. But then that's created other social problems, massive venereal disease problem. People become so addicted, so attached to sense gratification, then homosexuality becomes another byproduct. So a lot of But spiritually, of course, such a situation is totally detrimental. What to speak of spiritually, I mean, even, you know, materially, it's a social problem. It's a very uncivilized way of acting, and so it creates a harm to civilization. So what happens is that such people in their future birth, they may be born as some kind of a appropriate species of life where they can just have sex life like that. They don't have to worry. As a monkey or a pigeon or so, I don't know what, you know, whatever the appropriate species is, where, you know, they can have sex life and they don't have to be responsible, they can fly off somewhere. But a human being is meant to be responsible. because we have to take the reactions for the karmas. So if we want to enjoy, we have to also take the responsibility for that. If we try to shortcut it or shortchange Krishna or the law of karma, in the end we get shortchanged. So the question, what about someone? It's natural people who wants to take all the responsibility, but that's part of life. You see, what are the responsibilities? They see what the happiness is there. If you try to develop a higher taste, because this is the highest happiness in material life, is basically sex life. Prabhupada explains that you're eating in one restaurant, and you know, you may be attached to eating in that restaurant, but then a friend takes you to another restaurant and said, look, this restaurant's got better food. Then you don't, it's not a question, so you don't go to the old restaurant anymore because you found a better restaurant. It's not like a big, you know, just renouncing was authorized in previous ages for the sake of doing some kind of impersonal meditation or something, but it's forbidden in this age because nobody has the willpower to just renounce. What's in this age, that type of renunciation is forbidden. One has to develop a higher taste. When a person actually experiences more happiness in the Krishna consciousness, and therefore they're not attracted anymore, they don't consider that the happiness of sex life to be comparable with the happiness of spiritual life, then it's automatic that their renunciation is complete. Of course, you have to remain. In other words, you can't starve a person. If you got a better restaurant, he goes there. But if he's starving, you know, then he'll take anything that comes along. So when a person becomes lax in their spiritual life, when they don't maintain that taste for Krishna consciousness because of offenses, because of different neglect of their spiritual practices, then they put themselves in a vulnerable position, in a hungry kind of position, where then again material sense gratification. We have to be happy. Nobody can live without being happy. And if it's not material happiness, if it's not spiritual happiness, it's going to be material happiness. If it's not material happiness, then it has to be spiritual happiness. There's no alternative. You can't remain like in some kind of unhappy state and be stable, because it's our nature to be happy. So that's why a person needs to develop that higher taste. And Prabhupada wants you to have, if you're full and happy, you're satisfied, that is, you're controlled. And if you're not satisfied, then you're in difficulty. Of course, great yogis, they have, you know, practicing, and they had that great desire to achieve the spiritual realization while they were still practicing, before they were completely full. That sometimes the demigods would get worried that these great rishis who have got so much power that they may create some kind of imbalance in our universal power structure. They would sometimes send, you know, beautiful heavenly damsels to distract the yogis from their spiritual practices as a decoys. And they would sometimes succumb to these allurements, and that would delay their whole progress. The same kind of a situation, not exactly the same, but a similar situation happened where people tried to send beautiful women to Haridas Thakur to distract him. But because he was already full in Krishna consciousness, so he wasn't attracted. Rather, the girl that was sent became a devotee. When they came to try and to catch Haridas Thakur having illicit sex, instead they found Haridas Thakur was gone, and the beautiful girl they had sent there was shaved up and wearing a white cloth and was sitting there chanting japa. Guy had a heart attack. Couldn't believe it. What happened to you? You know. Said, now I become a devotee. So that's not possible. You know, for a certain period of time, someone out of willpower can maintain, but unless you develop the higher taste and you really feel peaceful in your devotional service, then it's difficult to just renounce like that. It's not recommended. When a person, even if they are maybe, you see, very advanced in spiritual life, but if they become, you know, in a very intimate contact with women, because even science now says that there's like a certain hormones that are produced by the bodies of men and women, and when you get in close proximity, those hormones create secretions in the body and create certain things to happen. It's not even just a purely mental thing. It's like nature has made it to keep the world populated. Has all these inborn mechanisms going on. Therefore, normally a woman is not supposed to come even within 1 meter, even within 3 feet of a man, of a sannyasi. People always come, the women, sometime in America, they complain, why is it the women have to stand separately? Why can't we all dance together and everything? But how is it possible for a man to maintain his brahmachari or his sannyas, if they're intimately connected like that, they're automatically the hormones are going to start to churn around and people are going to, start feeling different kind of stimulations. Not even that it's just something physiological. So for spiritual life, therefore people are supposed to stay a little bit separate, men, women, they can just, don't get all the hormones unnecessarily agitated when you're trying to chant Hare Krishna. So this is very hard for some, people, the guests here in America to understand because nobody's even thinking about anything like that, chanting Hare Krishna or being God conscious or self-realized. They're just, it's like a socially completely different, diametrically opposed from the normal way things are happening in America or in the West. So they don't understand it. When you have a long, narrow temple, then, like in Mayapur, we have a very wide temple. It's 80 feet wide, so the Mahārājas stand left side, the right side, and we stand, the men stand the left side. But in a temple where you have long and thin, so then, there's not that much room, so then sometimes they stay in the back and they complain, why we have to stand in the back, why can't we be in the front? It's just a question of the way you got your temple laid out. If you got a wide enough temple, stand on the side, there's no problem. But just that point that there should be a separation. This is the Vedic recommendation in the temples. In the household, you be together. And when you're married, you're together. And you're in the family, the husband and, people are together. But it says in the Vedas also that a man shouldn't sit even alone in some place right next to his mother or his daughter. Because it doesn't matter. It's a female and a male body. We're naturally going to start to produce the stimulation. And it's not good to just sit in some solitary place alone. If there's other people there, there's like some social restraint maybe. But these things are going to start to happen. So the Vedic society is geared to helping people to control themselves for focusing their energy on self-realization. And it also has the facility for enjoying, but that's done in a particular way. It's done in a, maybe this way it's done in earthly planet is one way. If you go on the higher planetary system, actually, Kardamuni is not a resident of Earth. He may have visited here, been here, done some tapasya here, but he's traveling in the higher planetary systems when these things happen. They have a whole different setup. That's why people in the Quran and the Bible, they learn to go to heaven. There's heaven and there's the kingdom of God. It's two different things. Heaven is where you really can enjoy life. And the kingdom of God is where you serve God, purely. I don't know, they don't know the difference in Christianity. I don't think they know the difference in the Quran, but in the Vedas they give a distinction that there's the heavenly planets and then there's the spiritual world. So you want the enjoyment, you have to take the, materially, you have to take the responsibility. You want to live in America, you got to pay your taxes. You want to make $1 million, you got to also pay your tithe. Otherwise, it's like that lady who was a big hotel owner in New York. She's a big millionaire, but she wasn't paying any taxes. And she told people only stupid people pay taxes and only poor people pay taxes. And then, the IRS heard about it and they took her to court and then they found, she got a big, heavy sentence. So that's the nature of the material world. You can enjoy, but then you're responsible. So that's frustrating people. Otherwise, I don't want to be responsible. I don't want to have to do, but what's the choice? You want to be responsible for the bad parts of life, then you become God conscious and develop a higher taste and then you'll become free from this. That's the only way. If you try to avoid it by any other way, you just get more entangled. Then a person becomes, in the being responsible, that's like in the mode of passion. You either got to go up to the mode of goodness or pure goodness and become more renounced, become more spiritual, and then you can transcend this type of responsibility. But if you try to just avoid it, you become in some mode of ignorance. And then you become more entangled. You become like an alcoholic or he wanders around and he becomes more degraded. And he goes down and down. So the laws of karma are like that. You either can stay the same and be in the mode of passion. You can go up spiritually in mode of goodness and even get elevated. Or like Kardamuni, some people they do tapasya to have a higher enjoyment later. They can see, well, this enjoyment is nothing much, but maybe the higher planets. But if you completely become irresponsible, you become in a mode of ignorance, tamas, and you become degraded. Go back to being an animal or something. No free rides, unfortunately. So, you know, the positive alternative of Krishna consciousness. There's no kind of negative aspect to spiritual happiness. There's no entanglement. But devotees are very responsible. They can understand that. And they're doing it out of love for Krishna. So even there, here you have to do a material. Well, maybe a person doesn't want to do it, but he just has to do it. So it's like a headache. But because the devotee is doing their service for Krishna, out of love of Krishna, so even the work is happy. One likes to do the service. If someone's actually, you know, a fixed up devotee, they're very happy in their devotional service. I gave this experience in South America. I told this story a few times. Of, like devotees, you know, you had to call them, it's time for prasadam, or it's time, you know, generally they like to do their service, you know, especially. I was in this one printing factory to make some contract. They were printing some of our books, and I was being taken there by the temple president and showing me the books, the BBT manager. It was at late at night, like 8 o'clock, and it was like the last shift. So at 8:30 or 9, I forget the time, where they talked to the manager, were looking into things. All the people are working, printing, you know. It was really active, you know, whole factory. You know, printing, got people doing layout, people on the printing machines, people cutting the paper, people binding. You know, it was like maybe a pretty medium-sized kind of printing press, maybe 50 presses or 25 presses. All of a sudden, I was just by the door. There's like the door, the punch card, and I was like a little table there looking at the layout of some of the first color prints that came out. The bell rang. It was 8:30, and all of a sudden, within seconds, every press was shut down. It was just like people, you know, just like, as soon as that bell rang, just within just a few seconds, there wasn't a press running, no light, everything was boom, off. And the people were like running, grabbing their coat, running, pushing and shoving, just boom, punching out at the punch card and boom, running out the door. And I was getting knocked over. Completely. It was like, I thought it was like a fire drill, you know. I mean, I never saw that. Anywhere. And people were running out of that place. Literally, I mean, it was just like if you had done a fire alarm or something, you know, it was like, poof, they're out, you know. Within 15 seconds, the place was, boom, empty. And they looked out the door and I saw people running off, you know. I don't know if it was the last bus or what, but they were gone, you know. And I just got the impression, you know, like, I mean, talk about attachment to your work. You know, here the devotees, they're like, you know, Lord Chaitanya is passing, see how Aguni, they're like fighting who can serve Krishna, who can carry more water and clean and so enthusiastic. Here the people are like fighting to get out of there. It's like, can't wait to get out. You know, it's like, you know, time is up. Like, let's get out of here. So, I mean, it's obvious. They just want to get their money and then get out. You know, it's like they're not like enjoying what they're doing. It's like they did, you know, it wouldn't like, work a few more minutes or something. Where the devotees, they enjoy what they're doing because the work is connected to Krishna. So even the service itself is our form of reciprocating with Krishna. The devotees enjoy that. Any other question?
I can ask you a question, but it might not be related to this subject.
Whatever you like. If it's related to Krishna.
I'd like your opinion about something. It's very interesting. When the headlines of the Tanskrit year in newspaper in New Orleans, they talk about the big universities up north and the government is experimenting with putting fetuses, the organs of fetuses into animals now, which is they experimented putting fetuses into mice. So now we have half mice and half humans on this planet, which I think is really disgusting to me. They're using this for AIDS research, and I was wondering comically, I mean, what is going to happen to the child that they destroyed and put into a rat? And what is the consequences of the people who are actually doing this comically? What are they going to wind up turning into? I was in the headlines of the newspaper, and I was really wondering about how far we're going as a nation with scientific research, with ongoing children, since we kind of like want to
Wow. It's a big topic.
I mean, along the axis of this species, this human race, and we worship in Krishna, how low are we going to go that we actually take the number one children and put their organs into, like, rats?
It definitely sounds like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, 16th chapter, I believe, divine and demoniac natures, that the demoniac can do all kinds of horrible works to achieve their ends. That there's certain natural... When you don't believe that there's a God, that there's a natural order to things, if you just think that everything is accidental, so that philosophy lends itself to people that, well, if it's all accidental, then we can just kind of make things happen a little faster, and we can start to do things. So basically, because society is more, the whole structure of science and the whole structure of the government policy, apart from the fact that the money says in God we trust, that the philosophy is basically godless, and that everything happened... Every day you read in the paper, people get the Nobel Prize because they've come up with a theory about the Big Bang or about things coming from the primordial soup. You go to Epcot Center and Disney Epcot Center, and they again and again give this philosophy on how everything comes simply from materialistic evolution. There's no higher intelligence. There's no higher order. There's no higher reality. So because of that, then people, they do all the, they think they can do anything. What they're going to create, what, your guess is as good as what happens from doing these things. Certainly, doing these things is not going to, in the long run, it's going to produce a lot of complications. The more we mess around with nature, just like now we're facing with ecological imbalances, there, we may end up with all kind of biological imbalances, whole kind of weird species of people who are, you know, going around and spreading rabies, and who knows what's going to happen. Anybody's guess, because we're messing around with things we shouldn't be messing around with. But the reason they can logically do it and get and feel that it's all right comes from evolution, and there's no higher reality or God. And this way they get away with anything they want. And what they were doing is that we as a human race, as a imbalances, just like came in the paper yesterday, that there's so much cancerogenic emissions coming from the paper factories in Georgia alone, that it's like something like 25 times more than the danger level. But people don't know, they're just breathing the air, that inside it there's all these kind of... people are getting cancer because of all these big factories that's producing so many things. Now the government's trying to control that. It's like all after the fact, and after we... A whole way of life in America, the whole philosophy of life needs to be improved to be spiritualized. People need to be more... to understand what is the reality. Unfortunately, science is never going to be able to give all the answers because this whole premise is very limited. So this is where it's our duty to spread Krishna consciousness. We have our scientific wing, and they're also trying to use science as far as possible to prove different Krishna conscious, I don't know what you call it, premises or principle or truth, so that we can have a society that's not godless. This type of godless society is going to go on producing so many difficulties. It's because basically the society is going on in a godless way, in a demoniac way. And your guess is as good as mine, what's going to be produced by all these new, you know, crazy things that people do, all because they think they're as good as God and that there is no higher truth. If we know that there's a God, you know, there's a supreme truth that we follow with the way. Then we are responsible to not only human beings but also to animals. Why? What right do we have to? We don't have right to take the embryos out of the womb. But because they say that life only begins after 6 weeks, but according to Vedas, life begins at conception, and only the Catholics and the The Buddhists and the Vedas, they agree, but of course the Buddhists don't practice what they follow, what they preach anymore. Practically, very few do. So they're, but neither does anybody in the world practice what the philosophy is. But the actual philosophy in the Vedas, even that was given by, and by Buddha as well as what's given, must be in the Bible if the Catholics believe it, is that the life begins at conception. The life doesn't actually begin, life is already there, but that's according to the Vedas, when the soul enters into the womb and it begins the life cycle of that particular organism. Not that it begins at the time of 6 weeks, when the consciousness is a little more developed. Life is there even before the consciousness is developed enough to express itself. But they have, like, they got it all worked out, and so that gives them the 6 week period that they can start to take embryos and play around with it. So knowledge is the best remedy for ignorance, and although they're very learned in certain aspects of science, but in the overall picture, they're considered to be maya prahita jnana, learned people whose intelligence has been stolen by illusion, as mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. Hare Krishna.